from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wall Street Journal columnist Kimberly Strassel says the left is playing an intimidation game, a coordinated strategy to silence the right. She sees it in what she calls liberal harassment against conservative politicians, in the targeting of Tea Party groups by the IRS, in the harassment of donors and businesses supporting conservative causes by progressives. If you're liberal, her argument may leave you wondering if you share the same world, but we're going to hear it this hour on Point. Kim Strassel on her new book, The Intimidation Game. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Who do you see boxed in, boxed out in American politics today? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Kimberly Strassel. She's a columnist and member of the editorial board at The Wall Street Journal. Her new book is The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Kim Strassel, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's so nice to be here.
You're taking this well beyond the kind of chill on campuses that we have heard about from conservative critics for a long time, saying they don't feel free to say what they feel, and when they do, they're censured. I got to say, to a lot of people, I dove into this, and I've read a bunch here, and a lot of people are going to be smacking their head. I mean, liberals start out with Citizens United as the sort of contemporary or latest source of all evil, money gushing down over our politics, dark money, turning American democracy into a kind of a circus for sale. You take that in just the other direction and see pushback to Citizens United as what, Kim?
Yeah, so the argument in this book is that Citizens United was, in fact, an important day. But from my perspective, it was because when the court came out and they said that all of these groups that had basically been boxed out of campaigns for a long time, when they struck down a lot of those speech laws, I call them speech laws, some people call them campaign finance laws, when they struck them down and let everybody go back in, a lot on the left were obviously very unnerved. We've been having a discussion about that ever since 2010. But their decision was, and you can see this in the writing, it's out there. They talk about it. They have conferences. They say it openly. They say, okay, if we can no longer outright use these laws to bar certain people from taking part in the conversation, then instead we're going to threaten and intimidate and harass and make it painful for them to continue talking. And I argue that that is what we have seen through the IRS, through this terrible Wisconsin investigation into 30 conservative groups up in that state, to individual donors and citizens out in places like California and Idaho, and to business groups that are exercising what, even though the left may not like it, is their constitutional right to participate in elections.
I want to come back and look at those stories, but just to sit back for a minute, I mean, you must feel the sort of through-the-looking-glass response that some people have to this. It's like, wait a minute, you say this group is muzzling free speech. They think they're fighting desperately against a kind of democracy for sale to dark money, for the very democratic nature of our nation not to be sold out to people who just happen to have the most.
Oh, I don't doubt that there is a lot of people who think that. And I think it's because we have an unfortunate view of money in politics. You know, I'm not going to say that money is speech, but money is a proxy for speech. I think everyone would have to agree that if you told a presidential candidate that they could only spend $50 in the course of their entire presidential campaign, people would agree that they would have a difficult time getting their message out.
Yep. So
the question then is, how much money should you get to spend? And I find it strange that if we do acknowledge that money in some way does facilitate ability to get out speech, that anyone could then argue that if you cut back on money, you are cutting back on speech. And so those who argue that Citizens United unleashed politics for sale, I don't see it as transactional that way. I see it as an expression of people's speech and taking part in civic society.
But surely you can also see that money can buy votes, so big money over time. I mean, we see how contributions and voting records do tend to line up over time. And does that not give you any pause, any concern? Does it not make you sympathetic in some way with those who say, wait a minute, this is a freight train, we've got to put some guardrails alongside?
I mean, I don't know, how do you add those things up? Like, for instance, when unions give donations to liberal politicians, I don't in any way have an issue with that, because in my mind, a union is a collection of many, many different Americans working in a trade, and together their voice is more powerful than one person all on their own. So, I mean, would you say that when many, many union members come together and they all push for a policy and they give money to a politician who supports that policy, is that democracy for sale?
I don't know if it's democracy for sale. I suppose people might say, well, yes, that they're looking for influence there. But at least if they get it, the results, the fruits of that, ideally would be spread throughout the laborers, the workers who are part of that union. Just on the other side of the ledger, the sort of archetypal fear is of a single billionaire, let's say, financing campaigns, maybe with dark money, pursuing one individual's interest rather than the broader interest. And maybe that's where the concern comes in.
Well, I think that's always possible, but it is interesting to me that often those who dislike Citizens United and complain about this and say democracy is for sale, they're not necessarily talking about one person. They're talking about companies in a whole. And I would argue that in that regard, companies are much the same as unions, and that they represent, in some cases, tens of thousands of workers who, in those companies' views, would benefit from limited government or fewer regulations or some of the things that the politicians that they support advocate in government.
Kim, we'll let our listeners judge. Take us into the stories that you tell in The Intimidation Game and what you see them lighting up.
Yeah, so I mean, coming off of this idea that after Citizens United, there was this sort of concerted attempt to do something, I think the first case you get is the IRS. And it still is frustrating to me. There is this line that continues to come out of Washington that, and President Obama says it, that, well, this was still just, this was a couple of Cleveland agents who didn't know how to read the law, and it was all just a mistake, a boneheaded error.
And I think the Inspector General said that in the IRS report, right, that there was no political guidance here. They did say it was a screw up, but wrong.
No, the Inspector General, and I think if you go back and look, he wasn't looking, he didn't go back and, in fact, investigate any of the causes of how this happened. He said he didn't, just in his cursory glance at this, find evidence, for instance, of a phone call from the White House telling somebody to take up arms against these groups. But I think if you go and you actually look at the record of what we do have, what is very clear is that you did, in that period of time, following the Citizens United decision, you had many, many Democratic senators and congressmen sending letters to the IRS saying, you know, someone's got to do something about all these nonprofits that are flooding into the political arena.
Because they were worried that they were like covers, that we wouldn't have transparency about what was going on.
Well, let's be clear, these are social welfare organizations in some cases, 501c4s.
I mean, by definition, they're social welfare, but they can represent almost anything.
They can, well, because that is true, because your definition of what counts for social welfare may be very different from my definition of what counts as social welfare. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that this is interesting. There are plenty of groups on the left that have very long acted as 501c4 social welfare organizations who engage deeply in politics. Mm-hmm. And liberals never had any issue with that until conservatives began to move into this sphere, in particular the Tea Party movement. And then the president was out every day in 2010 on the stump warning about these nonprofits, saying, you know, they could be very shady. We don't know who's giving them money, maybe foreign companies. They might be foreign controlled. You know, it was sort of Thomas Beckett, you know, who will rid me of this troublesome priest? And guess what? The IRS did in the end. So this wasn't a bunch of line agents. We've got all the evidence of who was looking at this, how it got sent to Washington, how Washington took over that operation, how Washington made the decisions about putting these applications on ice. This was not a screw up in some distant remote area. It was orchestrated out of D.C.
I don't know how to come to a final conclusion on the level of that orchestration. I mean, could you think you could nail that down in a way that would stand up in the court of law? The Inspector General and the IRS did not.
Yeah, if you go through the investigations that subsequently came out in the House and the Senate, and by the way, in particular, the one in the Senate, which was bipartisan, it was done between the Oregon senator, and Ron Wyden, and Orrin Hatch. It's pretty clear that Washington was central to what happened here, that we don't have every email because, of course, a lot of those emails disappeared. But yeah, there is very good evidence. I mean, what we do have, for instance, is we've got a line agent back, just as the Obama administration said, a line agent who did indeed send the first case on to Washington and said, you know, this is the sort of case that's been getting media attention lately. And by the way, I'm assuming that that was a reference to President Obama talking about these cases all the time. And he sent it to Washington. And then basically within 24 hours, Washington said, we're on it. And, you know, that's clear from the record.
You really see a coordinated campaign across all the stories you tell in this book, a kind of bunker somewhere where some, you know, left-wing central is saying, stop
no,
that, muzzle
no,
that.
No. No, no. That's no more likely than there is a vast right-wing conspiracy either. But as we all know, and you know too, Tom, you cover politics, is that tactics and strategies have a way of them being replicated and growing and mimicked. And so I think what started out, like I'll give you a good example. One of the cases I mentioned in the book talked about how Dick Durbin sent a letter out to a whole bunch of nonprofits asking if they supported, gave financial donations to a group called the American Legislative Exchange Council.
ALEC.
And ALEC is an organization that, whether you approve of its policies or not, it develops model policy and tries to push it at the state level.
Kim, that's such an important story. I wish you'd hold it. We'll come back and look at it after a short break right here. Kimberly Strassel is with us. Her new book is The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Kim Strassel. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a conservative complaint that their views are being muzzled, that conservative campaigners are being intimidated, shut down by the left. Wall Street Journal columnist Kimberly Strassel makes the charge. Her new book is The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. She joins us from New York, and you can join us as well. You're listening. She's telling the stories, putting what she sees as her evidence on the table here. She does it in the book. Do you see the right being unfairly hounded, harassed, harangued in a kind of coordinated campaign? Is the right really muzzled when Fox News is hosting big presidential debates, when anybody can spend anything to make their political point? Conservatives, do you find yourself in circumstances where you cannot speak your mind? Lots of callers for you, Kim, but give us the story. We began to get into it of Dick Durbin and ALEC. ALEC, of course, is the group that's gone all over the country. State legislatures are where they really focus. They bring in model legislation. It drives many liberals crazy because they're very successful at pushing it through, and they can push back in a lot of ways that are very conservative, backed by some very large corporations, Coca-Cola, you write about, Visa and others. And what the left wanted to push back on that funding of ALEC, and you and others take exception to how that unfolded. Tell us.
Yeah. So, and we were talking about this in the regard and the question of how these tactics spread. And I wanted to focus on this because it was a good first example in that Dick Durbin went out and sent this letter to about 1,000 different corporations and nonprofits saying, "Do you give money to ALEC?" Now, by the way, this was an outrageous request anyway, because ALEC is not required to report its donors, nor are those donors expected to give up that information. So he was asking for something that was protected by law. But he did this, and you remember this all came in the context of the Trayvon Martin shooting, and ALEC had at one point pushed Stand Your Ground laws across the
country. And people were outraged, and they turned around and they said, where do these laws come from? It looked like they came from ALEC, and they went after ALEC because
they went after ALEC. But although, interestingly, you know, they were outraged. These were laws that, by the way, were passed in more than 30 states, many of them signed by Democratic governors. So this was not a sort of – this was a bipartisan push in many ways for these bills.
But it was a watershed moment. People looked at this case and said, oh, we have to – this is nuts. We have to do something here.
So that is the context for this. Dick Durbin sends out this letter, and it was a very threatening letter. It said, did you give money? And essentially, if you did, you may be accused of being a racist organization the way that ALEC is. It was essentially what his letter summed up to be. Now, there was an enormous outcry when he sent this letter. Even his hometown newspapers wrote things saying Durbin's enemies list. And, you know, you don't get to use the power of your office to go out and sort of level this kind of intimidation and say, do you give money? And if so, you may be in trouble. You know, being a senator is a very important and powerful job. So he got some pushback on that, and he ultimately dropped that inquiry. But we have seen that replicated again and again now. It became a model. So we've had Senate Democrats who've recently sent out letters to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's members saying, do you support the Chamber of Commerce's views on climate science? If you do, you know, watch out. We've had, Raul Grijalva, a member of the House, sending harassing letters to the universities that employ scientists who put out climate science with which he does not agree, saying, I want 10 years of your correspondence and all of the work that they've done there. This is pure harassment. Or we have the attorneys general right now who are all out doing the same thing with ExxonMobil, not just going after ExxonMobil, but sending subpoenas to any groups that work with it, again, because of climate science with which they don't agree.
You call it pure harassment, but what about somebody with a different view who would say, what if we've had decades of a kind of corporate conspiracy on this side of climate denial with many allies in that and, of course, huge financial interest in it? I mean, we're talking oil here. It's big money. How do you get at that if not in this way? Maybe Dick Durbin overstepped the bounds as a senator. But what's the argument against transparency and understanding who's funding what views that are framing the way our democracy works?
Well, if you really want to turn people's science and their thoughts into potential fraud, I mean, we are really opening a Pandora's box.
What if they are fraud?
Okay, well, we just had a letter that we ran at the Wall Street Journal from a number of other attorneys generals that said, well, I don't know, what if I, as an attorney general, were now to sue Al Gore and Kleiner Perkins where he works because Al Gore is making allegations that are not supported by science in terms of the extreme weather, for instance, or dire predictions about what may happen. And if those do not come to transpire, I mean, maybe we should sue renewable energy companies who are making a claim to investors that all of this is going to happen, and maybe it won't. And then as a result, they've defrauded their investors. I mean, this is a very slippery slope.
I mean, we went after tobacco companies after they hid evidence of the health dangers of cigarettes for many years and denied. Is climate so different?
I think it absolutely is different because, I mean, first of all, no one's dying from this in
really?
The country.
That's not true. People are dying from climate change. Maybe not in your backyard, but you look globally. You've got drought. You've got fires. You've got issues.
There are excellent arguments by people who, by the way, agree with the sort of climate science out there that is supposedly supported by 95% of climate scientists. Yeah. Guys like Bjorn Lomborg, who make the case that actually a rising temperature will save more lives in the end than it kills. So, you know, I mean, again, this is just a slippery slope if you're going to suggest that you should criminalize climate science.
What about the transparency issues, Kim? You look at the push for transparency as harassment, and some might look at it as a desire to know what's going on in our political life. Why do you see the call for and push, and sometimes a rough push in here for transparency as an offense to free speech?
I think it's something more we just as a society really need to rethink and debate. Because remember, look, the idea behind transparency and disclosure is wonderful. We want to know who's giving money to the politicians in the sense that you mentioned to make sure that there is no transactional nature to
politics.
But
when people ask for that, you say they're harassing them.
No. So what I'm talking about, but our disclosure regime has now extended well beyond that to the point where what's happening is these groups are trying to get this information solely so that they can go intimidate people. And I think what is really interesting to me here is that this used to be a point that the left understood better than anyone. In fact, the left drove it. One of the reasons that we have this debate, one of the reasons why we have some anonymity in politics is because of the civil rights era. And there was a very famous Supreme Court case, the NAACP versus Alabama, in which an attorney general in Alabama who supported Jim Crow laws, wanted the names of all the members of the NAACP in Alabama. Okay, and this was in 1958.
Yep.
It was clearly done. If the NAACP had turned those over, it would have been the equivalent of a hit list.
Yeah.
Okay, these were
a
period of lynchings and firebombings. So the Supreme Court said, no, the right to free speech is integrally connected to the right to freedom of association, like what happens with the NAACP. But those two things are also integrally connected to the right to some anonymity in politics. You do not have to put out everything, especially because of the threat of reprisal and harassment and intimidation.
Who's intimidated now, then? Are the Koch brothers intimidated?
Well, let me give you an example. Think about all those Americans out in California who a few years ago gave money to the Prop 8 campaign, supporting a traditional marriage amendment to the Constitution.
Yep.
Those people, activists who disagreed with them, went through the disclosure lists that we're talking about and put all of their names and addresses on a searchable, walkable map. And then they went from house to house. People had their cars keyed. They had their windows broken. They had harassing messages put on their voicemails. They lost their jobs. There were flash protests outside their businesses. So is this what we want to use transparency and disclosure for? As a way of teeing up people for reprisal. And you know, it's very disturbing to me. How is that any different than the risks that were present in NAACP versus Alabama?
Well, I mean, first of all, keying and lynching are different. But do you really feel like Americans—
Losing your job? Yeah, I mean,
no,
that was something that was
specifically
mentioned in NAACP versus Alabama, that the loss of livelihood was a huge risk of handing over this list.
Do you really feel that American corporations and conservatives are sort of up against a wall, muzzled here? That is your assertion, but look around. There seems to be lots of expression of conservative perspective in this country. Lots.
So, first of all, a lot of the book is about the attempt to do that. And I'm actually happy to report that there are many groups that have refused to bow over to that, okay? And I think, too, sometimes it's overstated because there are some groups that are just incredibly politically active, some Tea Party organizations and things. But they are not representative of the vast number of conservatives who are out there. And one of the reasons I brought up that Prop 8 campaign out in California is that we know about these instances because people ended up signing depositions. And what was notable about most of those depositions is that they all ended with the person in question who'd been targeted saying, "This will discourage me in future from taking part in politics."
Kim Strassel's new book is The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. And in just a couple of minutes here, we're going to hear from Bhaskar Sunkara with the Jacobin, the left-leaning political magazine. We've got a lot of callers for you, Kim. Let's go to some of them. Jim in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Jim, you're on the air with Kim Strassel.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I really am amazed to hear how the victims are the conservatives and the corporations when the Supreme Court has declared corporations to be people. Moreover, corporations can even practice religion. So to hear Kim say how wonderful the corporations represent their workers is utter nonsense. The owners, the management, the stockholders in chief of these corporations determine that Hobby Lobby doesn't want their employees to have birth control. That's free speech. So corporations are people that practice religions, and money is speech. And they are the victims of this terrible, terrible freeze on speech. What nonsense. The reason Bernie is so popular is because corporations have put a stranglehold on freedom of expression in our country. Everyone else is drowned out. Mr. Trump, he happened to have his own money. He didn't need to spend $50 because people are looking at him like people watch an accident on the street, and he gets all the free press he could possibly use.
Kim, hang on, Jim. Kim, what do you say to Jim? You hear where he's coming from.
Corporations represent millions upon millions of Americans. And yes, do some people at the top, do boards have to make decisions? Yes, just like union leaderships make decisions at the top, too. So, you know, you can't have a collective free-for-all in terms of people deciding where an organization's money is going to go. But I think it's important what your caller just said. He acknowledged the Supreme Court says that corporations have a fundamental constitutional right to participate. And I know there are a lot of people who are unhappy about that, but it is nonetheless a right.
The thing is, Kim, yes, millions may work for corporations, but we've seen what happens, what has happened with the distribution of income and wealth in this country when that goes into fewer and fewer pockets, or the bulk of it. Does that change the equation here? Are they really representing all those millions? They may have employees, but is it the same as representing them?
I don't know. I look at people like my grandmother who, you know, for instance, is a shareholder in a one of those widows and orphans funds.
Yep.
And for years and years and years, that quarterly check allowed her to not only pay her bills, but continue on and have a few little luxuries in life. So, you know, corporations are behind all of that, too. And to suggest that all of the wealth that comes from them is just amassed at the top is utter nonsense.
Well, not all, of course. That would be utter nonsense. But we do know where the amassed is, and we do know that it's become much less equal than it once was.
Well, there is a lot of money that does go to top corporate executives, and those companies have to make that decision about how much they pay and whether or not they're willing to face the blowback that comes from that. But, I mean, if you really want to get into income inequality, it isn't really necessarily always the result or much the result of corporations and their decisions about corporate executive pay. This has much more to do with a faltering and difficult economy at the moment.
Nathan in Lynchburg, Virginia. Nathan, you're on the air with Kim Strassel. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I'm a conservative, and just to give you an example of the bullying right now, I put a Trump sign out in my yard because I support Trump.
Okay.
And I would have to say that it was a Democrat or a liberal who decided to rewrite the message on it. And but you know, we get it at our rallies, our Trump rallies. We get people beaten up, eggs that we can't even like congregate. Safely for something that we believe in without being harassed. We get it everywhere, all over the media. Any conservative person at all right now, because of the politically correct charged atmosphere of the past 8 years of the administration that's still in, has gone totally against us and turned us into racists and bigots, no matter if we're right or wrong. If we don't agree with them, they automatically want to throw the race card, even though racism is an issue that goes both ways and all over society.
Nathan, do you think it's changed? Is it different today than it once was? If you've been a conservative for a long time, do you think the?
Oh yes. The Democrats have definitely done their job. They have definitely. Obama's definitely gotten some legislation passed that we definitely do not agree with, and will have to be changed back for sure.
Nathan, I appreciate your call. And let me get one more, and I'll bring it to you, Kim. Sarah in Boston. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. So the guy that just spoke, I agree with his right to say what he wants to say. I'm a liberal.
Okay.
I don't think it's okay to go against somebody just because they have a difference of opinion. However, I do think that, let's see, all the conservatives that amassed at abortion clinics,
yep,
and harass all the people going in. Okay.
Yep.
Secondly, Citizens United, free speech, money. Oh, really don't believe that that's the truth and that those two things are equated. I do think that there's been a real suffering of actual free speech in the United States over the last 30 years. I don't know where it's
for everybody, exactly. For liberals, for conservatives, for who, Sarah?
For everybody.
Yeah, I'm curious on that too.
I can't even say in the presence of somebody that so-and-so down the street looks pretty because, oh, God, that would be body-conscious speech and somehow hurt one person and not favor the other, all the kids getting trophies for every little bit of participation. What happened to people being individuals? What happened to not bowing under for peer pressure? What happened to being an individual with an opinion and being able to disagree with the next person without it being fisticuffs?
Sarah, I appreciate your call as well. Kim responded to those two. Just got half a minute before the break here. But you've got your conservative in Virginia who feels he can't even put his Trump sign out. And Sarah has got a kind of broader complaint there.
Yeah, no, I mean, it has changed. There is no question. You go out and you talk to the average conservative and the feelings against them are much worse than they were 8 years ago. And by the way, I agree with Sarah that it is very worrisome that we have kind of got this PC culture in one regard in which you feel like you can't say anything about anybody anymore.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about a conservative complaint that their views are being muzzled. That conservative campaigners are being intimidated or shut down by the left. Wall Street Journal columnist Kimberly Strassel is making that charge in her new book, The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech, she says. You can join us. Is Kim Strassel telling it like it is? Is she spinning? Is this about free speech? Is this about winning? Do you see American conservatives boxed in, beleaguered, intimidated? Lots of response online here. Patrick says, Kimmy says, 80% of Americans want improvements in gun control. The NRA doesn't. Congress votes against gun control. Tell me again that the left is shutting down free speech. Okay. John, on the other hand, says, I do think we liberals are becoming guilty of the same actions we criticize to some degree. Hashtag look in the mirror. I prefer, says, I'm so weary of conservatives victimizing and then playing the victim card for themselves. Is brilliant and frightening in the way it mirrors itself. Daphne says, both sides are trying to reduce speech. Neither side is winning. Intelligent discussions on issues are rare. Kim Strassel joins us from New York. The book is The Intimidation Game. Kim, stand by for a second. Bhaskar Sunkara has been listening a bit here. He's publisher of Jacobin. It's a left-leaning political magazine. Bhaskar, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
I'm curious to hear what you make of Kim Strassel's charge that the conservative free speech is being muzzled by the left.
Well, I think we absolutely have to acknowledge that there is a history of liberal dismissal of the right, a kind of psychologization of being conservative. I think you saw that in the 50s and 60s, to some degree in the Brown Scare of the 1930s, which is often forgotten about between the two Red Scares. And there is a reason why.
You mean pushing back on McCarthyism? Is that what you mean?
Even before that, I'm talking about the 1930s and the way in which some legitimate political activity on the right was lumped in with fascism.
Okay.
In the 50s and 60s, I think a lot of vital center theorists were very quick to dismiss any strand of conservative thought as being really outside of the American mainstream and very much, you know, lumping them all in with the Birchers of the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there's a reason why, you know, very talented conservative scholars like George C. Nash had to retreat to think tanks. And one of the reasons why the right built up think tanks was because they were locked out of academia. And I do agree that I think we've seen this somewhat more recently in attempts to kind of delegitimize the Tea Party as kind of astroturf and so on, which I think is a mistake because the left should be, you know, learning from some aspects of the Tea Party and how they managed to organize. And of course, they were funded, but you know, I imagine any left wing efforts would be funded. But I do think it's a big mistake to kind of conflate these multiple kind of currents into one conception of the left. Like, in other words, I think the IRS case. You know, I don't know all the details of it, but I think that's very different than the currents of campus activism that's been discussed or the movement against for campaign finance laws and things like that. I think it's a huge mistake to kind of add in the IRS there because I do think there is a legitimate threat to free speech that does emerge from time to time in societies, but I think more often than not it comes from the state, not from these other groups. So I think when we're talking about suppression of dissent and things like that, I think the IRS scenario would be one to actually look closely at, but I don't think that there is, you know, it makes sense at all to lump other activity in with that.
I mean, it's interesting, Bhaskar, that Kim does not give that much attention to the big conversation that's gone on around free speech or suppression of dissent on campuses. She's really much more focused on these more institutional examples of what she calls the muzzling of free speech. I don't sense that much lumping in her book. She's more on the what she sees as a campaign side here.
Right, right. I mean, I think that that the question of whether or not there was a coordinated effort by, you know, the IRS with the Obama administration or whatnot. I mean, you know, I read Kim's column, but but you know, I just don't see that how that's connected to broader efforts by liberal activist groups and others around campaign finance and things like that. I think what's key to remember here is that, you know, you know, politics isn't kind of a salon-style fantasy where
nope.
ideas are kind of exchanged openly and the best one kind of wins out, you know, organizations like Heritage, like the Chamber of Commerce, you know, these are organizations that do have a lot of money and do have a lot of lobbyist clout, and they use it to influence policy in a certain way. And there's other organizations that don't have as much money and resources, so they rely on just mass membership and thus different organizing tactics to influence policy. To me, they're both expressions of speech, and I don't think there's particularly been massive efforts to clamp down on the right of conservative organizations to organize, especially today. And I think they have a lot of legislative successes they could point to over the last 8 years, especially at the state and local level, that that I think is more proof that they haven't been suppressed.
Kim, what about that? I mean, Alec, you cite instances where you see it as it being under fire or harassed, but I mean, it's hard to argue with what Bhaskar says there. They've had tremendous success in marching their model legislation out around the country. It hardly seems like that they're in a crouched position of intimidation.
Not now, but they nearly went under when this campaign began against them. This is an organization that survives on about $7 million a year, and they lost nearly half of their funding because of this campaign against their donors. But let me give you an example. You talk about maybe there isn't many ramifications. I don't know how closely you watch what happened in Wisconsin, where a liberal prosecutor launched a secret probe against 30 conservative groups that had supported Scott Walker's reforms, government reforms, up there during the recall elections. And this was done under something called a John Doe law. He didn't have to tell anyone about it. They confiscated email, all their documents. They raided people's homes in the morning, in the dark. In one case, they went into a home of a man, and he and his wife were out on a charitable fundraising trip. Their teenage son was home alone. He was made to get up, sequestered. He could not call his lawyer. He could not call his grandparents who lived down the road.
Was that
and
legal?
And when the police, well, under this John Doe law, apparently it was. And when he left, when they left, they informed him that if he told anybody about what would, had happened, he could go to jail. And this didn't just happen there. It happened in many people's homes. And by the way, at the end of all of this, it ended up finally coming out and finally going all the way up to the Supreme Court, who found that this entire investigation was bogus. The man who had launched it, he had been unhappy about Scott Walker's reforms. He was a district attorney. He had pursued campaign finance allegations. And this is, by the way, this is what the court wrote as it dismissed it. It was utterly clear the special prosecutor has employed theories of law that do not exist to investigate citizens who were wholly innocent of any wrongdoing. So that probe was about sending a message to conservative groups, which is, this is what's going to happen to you. Your life is going to get turned upside down and inside out if you continue to engage in politics.
And here's what Scott Walker himself had to say about it. This was April of last year on WHO News Radio in Iowa.
It was really about trying to intimidate people connected to organizations who had been supportive, not just of me, but of Senate Republicans and others who faced recalls a few years ago. And it should be chilling enough that shouldn't be just conservatives that are concerned about. I said, even if you're a liberal Democrat, you should look at that and be frightened to think if the government can do that against people on one political persuasion, they can do it against anybody.
Bhaskar Sunkara, are you willing to put that in the same, I don't know, basket as maybe government moves against anti-war protesters in the 1960s or black activists at that time?
And you don't even have to go that far. I mean, I completely agree that there is a threat that's often posed from the legal system, from the state, to activists of all persuasions. And sometimes it's a more coordinated effort, like it was in the 1960s, directed from the federal government. At other times, it just relies on the ill intention of people in positions of power. That's why, you know, we need to call them to account. But, you know, there's countless stories of the left being targeted in similar ways by the FBI and others, by activists for you know, peaceful protests, you know, being a kind of agent provocateur and otherwise, you know, abused. And I'm sure this happens as well on the right. So, again, I don't see how this is necessarily connected to broader moves by activist groups or by foundations fighting against for campaign finance laws or things like that. I think that there's a very strong case that Kim makes about these particular incidents of state repression, but I don't see the direct connection with broader moves by liberal and left advocacy groups.
Kim, stand by. Okay, sure.
Well, can I just, I mean, actually, they're directly connected, and I think that's the important part of this book. What are we talking about here? In all of these instances, or in many of these instances, whether it's Alec and its supporters, or whether it's the IRS targeting thing, or Wisconsin, what happened, you were talking about nonprofits or social welfare organizations or think tanks that have been targeted, and all on the same grounds, by the way. The IRS did this because they claim that, ooh, you know, these nonprofits, someone needed to do something about them. They might have been involved in politics. That was the same reasoning behind the Wisconsin prosecutor's move against these people. And all of it motivated, we know from emails from the staff who worked at the Wisconsin prosecutor's office and from the staff in Lois Lerner's office, and from groups that have attacked things like Alice, all of it motivated by an intense dislike of money in politics and a belief that Citizens United was wrong and that these organizations should not be allowed to play in the political game.
Yeah, but wait, you can't say, back off. If you don't like the way big money in politics is working, just leave us alone. We have a right to do whatever. You can't expect that in democracy. I mean, Bhaskar is bringing the sort of hurly-burly realities of political life into play here. If people oppose what those money-backed social welfare organizations, call them what you like, are up
it's
to.
It's the law.
Yes, but they have a right to try and oppose those moves as well. I mean, that's politics, right?
You can argue. My difference, by the way, is so you get to use your prosecutorial power to oppose them?
No, I don't. He says the activist groups who don't like it. If Van Jones doesn't like what Alec is up to, he's a free citizen to go out and try and organize.
Oh, I totally agree with that, except for, I mean, and by the way, protest and boycott products as you like. But I think there's a significant difference here. This is not the same as somebody saying, you know, I don't like the fact that Exxon drills its oil in this.
Yeah, but you go after Van Jones in your book for trying to organize an effort to get.
I do, because his protests and his boycotts are accompanied by a threat saying, we will not stop harassing and intimidate you until you voluntarily give up your constitutional
rights.
But that's
just a threat. Saying, stop, you're doing something we disagree with. We won't buy your Coca-Cola or use your Visa card. We'll tell people that you're backing Stand Your Ground law and Trayvon Martin is dead. But
and call you racist and run ads in your hometowns against your board members calling you a racist.
Isn't that just the rough and tumble?
It's what he's demanding in return. Give up your constitutional rights.
Roberta in Covington, Louisiana. Roberta, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
I want to respond to something someone else said, and this is how I see this. Liberals, I think it has to do with how liberals and conservatives process information and then put it back out.
Okay.
Liberals are bottom up. We learn about information and we compile it together to build a theory. And we're very scientific and rigorous about it. Conservatives, on the other hand, start from an emotional standpoint and build either facts or facts, things that aren't really facts, but they want them to be, to support their emotional point of view. And for years and years, we have put up with this behavior because we are collaborative, we're patient. But after mass murders, I'm not willing to be patient anymore. I am going beyond the point of educating, which is the point of view I had before, mm-hmm. and my liberal friends and progressive friends, mm-hmm. to the point of, we're not putting up with your behavior anymore. You're apologizing for the NRA because it goes up against your emotional rigidity. No more.
Roberta, we've got, I mean, this is interesting. This gets to the nub of something that may be in this conflict that you're describing, Kim. You've got people who just aren't buying some of the things that your political camp might be pushing for and feel like we've got to move past this gridlock. And, you know, I don't know if by whatever means necessary is a phrase that they would use, but there's some element of that in what you hear from our caller right there from Louisiana.
Well, I can't wait for Roberta to go and buy the book and other liberals so that they can see that this is entirely fact-based. if to use her term, I guess you would call it bottom-up. Did not come from an emotional perspective. In fact, the thing about it, and you've got one in front of you,
yes, I do.
Tom.
Yes, I do.
Full of dates and figures.
Oh, yeah.
And
no, you're
numbers.
Talking about the facts of what you describe as intimidation.
Of what I'm describing.
She's describing her argument, political positions, you know.
But she's suggesting that, you know, I guess I emotionally made this up.
No. It's the conservative positions that are being put forward
that she thinks she wants to push back on by whatever tools are at her disposal.
You know, I think a lot of conservatives actually believe they begin from the bottom up, too, with things like the Bill of Rights. Okay, so it sounds as though Roberta wants there to be more gun laws. Well, many conservatives begin with the basic premise, which, by the way, is not emotional. It's fact-based, that we have a Second Amendment and that the Supreme Court has declared that it means you have an individual right to bear arms.
Bhaskar, so, where do we go with this? You seem pretty open to concern on both sides of the political ledger here about the freedom of expression.
Right. Well, I absolutely disagree with Roberta's comment that I do think that's kind of the wrong approach liberals have always took to conservatism, which this kind of like looking at conservatism as a psychological flaw instead of a legitimate political expression. And there are legitimate reasons why people would vote Republican and so on. So I concede all that. I do think that there's a lot of these issues, a broader of free speech and civil society, you know, comes down to, for me, a tactical issues. You know, I do think that it's legitimate to, let's say, hypothetically, protest outside the home of Exxon CEOs, because what we try to do is impose costs on corporations and the people who run them. I think often it might not make tactical sense to do that, because the whole point is to kind of win an argument, and, you know, we have to be concerned about how things are going to be perceived. But I think something like that, for instance, is not an assault on free speech and not just protest. So I think that...
Bhaskar, that's as far as we get to take it today. I hope you'll come back again. It's been great to have you. Bhaskar Sunkara, publisher of Jacobin. Thank you very much, Bhaskar.
And thank you, Bhaskar.
And Kim Strassel, Kimberly Strassel, author of The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. It was interesting, Kim. Thank you very much for coming on. Good to have you.
Tom, it was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for all your input. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.